More than 5 months into the U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza, the Israeli regime continues its campaign of killing, destruction, and starvation against Palestinians. UN organizations issue fresh stark warnings about the growing levels of child malnutrition and infectious diseases in the Gaza Strip. Israeli media reports widespread blackouts in northern Israel following another rocket attack by Lebanon's Hezbollah. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the people made a great move by participating in Friday's elections, despite the enemy plots. Ayatollah Khamenei thanked the Iranians for taking part in the vote to choose members of parliament and the assembly of experts. He said that the enemies tried to dissuade the people from participating in the electoral process, but the people made an epic move by performing their social and cultural duties. The leader also thanked all those who were involved in the successful conclusion of the elections. Final results have already been out. In the race to the 290-seat parliament, 231 candidates have been declared winner. 72 contenders also grabbed seats in the 88-member Assembly of Experts. A second round of voting will be held in April to determine the fate of the rest of the seats in the two bodies. Now, more than 5 months into the Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, dozens of more people have lost their lives in overnight air raids. In the latest attack, the regime warplanes struck the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza City, killing 8 people and wounding several more. A number of homes were also targeted in the southern cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah, resulting in the death of nearly 30 people. The regime's naval forces also shelled the shores of Beit Lahia in the north. No casualties have been reported. IOF troops also once again opened fire on Palestinians trying to reach an aid truck in Gaza City, injuring several of them. The death toll from the onslaught on Gaza since early October has surpassed 30,600, mostly women and children. United Nations organizations warning that child malnutrition levels in northern Gaza are particularly extreme. A WHO representative told a meeting in Geneva that 1 in 6 children under the age of 2 are acutely malnourished in northern Gaza. Rick Pieperkin said that an estimated 8,000 patients need to be evacuated from the strip where most hospitals have been repeatedly targeted by the Israeli regime. Also, UNICEF spokesperson James Elder told the meeting that malnutrition rates for children under 5 in northern Gaza are extremely high. He said there is also a growing risk from infectious diseases, with 9 in 10 children under the age of 5 falling sick over the last weeks. Israeli media reporting a widening rift among members of the far-right Israeli cabinet and the military amid growing sentiment against Prime Minister Netanyahu's policies. The Israeli military's disagreements with ministers reached a new level in cabinet sessions. In a recent meeting, several ministers protested at the military chief, saying that the IOF ground operation in Gaza is not effective enough and it's too slow. In the meeting, Herzi Halevi, however, reminded his opponents about their initial refusal to start a ground operation. Now, this as Benny Gantz, a war cabinet member, is in Washington to meet with U.S. officials without the prime minister's permission. Gantz, a key political rival of Netanyahu, has faced backlash over the trip. He was not even facilitated by the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. Palestinians in occupied West Bank have laid to rest the body of a young boy who was killed in the latest Israeli attack near the city of Annapolis. The 10-year-old victim was shot in the head in the town of Burin, south of Annapolis. Regime incursion into the town also left 2 other people injured. Another Palestinian youth was killed in the town of Hawara, south of Annapolis. Israeli atrocities have surged across the West Bank, parallel to its bloody onslaught on Gaza. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed and thousands more injured in near daily raids on the occupied territory since early October last year. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil. She has some details on the latest Israeli raids across the West Bank.
This morning, the Israeli forces raided the village of Kobar, northwest Ramallah, and unfortunately detained a number of Palestinians. The majority of those Palestinians were former prisoners. Among those who had been detained, there is the wife of Nail al-Barghouthi, Aman Nafa. Nail al-Barghouthi, the longest-serving Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails, and she also was a former prisoner, and his sister Hanan al-Barghouthi, who had been released in the Swapda deal that was reached between the resistance group and the Israeli authorities when the Israeli war on the Gaza Strip started, and it's weird why the Israelis recently had been again rearresting those who had been released in the swap deal. The Israeli forces also stormed Qalandia refugee camp. Yesterday, the Israelis raided Qalandia refugee camp and a Palestinian was shot and killed during the operation. Again, today, the Israelis raided Qalandia refugee camp, and it seems that they insist to find those Palestinians who had been using their weapons during the military operation, because yesterday two Israeli soldiers were wounded during the military operation, and exchange of fire have taken place between Palestinians from inside the refugee camp and the Israeli forces. Today, a number of Palestinians had been detained during the military operation to Qalandia refugee camp in Nablus. And as usual, the Israeli forces used excessive force. They used their guns to disperse the people. A 10-year-old Palestinian was shot and killed, Amr al-Najjar, from the village of Burin, South Nablus. This child was shot in the head and immediately he was killed. Two more Palestinians were wounded during the military operation to Burin.
Now, Israeli media has reported widespread blackouts in the northern parts of the occupied territories following another rocket attack by Lebanon's Hezbollah. A barrage of rockets was fired at more than a dozen settlements and military bases in several towns, one of them hitting a utility pole. That prompted the Israeli officials to activate anti-missile systems that failed to intercept some of the rockets. The regime has refrained from revealing the severity of damage and a number of towns that plunge into darkness. Hezbollah's operations came in response to Israel's repeated attacks against southern Lebanon. Hezbollah and Israel have been engaged in exchanges of fire since the regime began its genocidal war on Gaza. Lebanese resistance fighters have mainly targeted Israeli military positions, but the Tel Aviv regime has even targeted residential areas in Lebanon, causing the death of a number of civilians. Iran's foreign minister has called on the Organization of Islamic Cooperation to take more effective action to help put an end to the Israeli brutal genocide of Palestinians. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made a call on meeting with OIC's Secretary General in the Saudi Arabian city of Jeddah. That's where an emergency meeting of the Organization of on Gaza is being held. Amir Abdullahian also told the OIC chief that the organization's members must make major decisions and send a strong message to Israel and its allies and deter further atrocities. In a meeting with Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan, Amir Abdullahian called for more efforts to help Gaza and to stop the Israeli genocide. The Saudi minister stressed the importance of collective efforts by Muslim nations in the international arena to support Palestinians. British politician and lawmaker George Galloway has warned about a current state of the UK, saying that the country is at a very dangerous crossroads.
I think that we stand at a very dangerous crossroads in our country's affairs, perhaps as dangerous as any since the summer and autumn of 1940-41. And there's no Mr. Churchill in this picture. There's no one, it seems, able to step forward and steady the ship of state and begin to rally, unite our people to face what is a very difficult future. Poverty stalks the land, child poverty in particular.
Galloway made those comments after being sworn in as an MP following his by-election victory in Rochdale. He said his job was to make Rochdale great again. He ran a campaign focused on stopping the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. The British political scene is undergoing profound changes marked by legal disputes and a significant decline in public support for the ruling Conservative Party, an Ipsos poll indicating that support for the Conservatives, who have been in power for 14 years, was at 20% at the end of February. So let's bring in Saeed Pourreza from London. Saeed, good to have you with us. So tell us how this happened and on what ticket George Galloway made his way back to the British Parliament again.
Well, it all started, of course, in the by-elections in Rochdale, a constituency in the greater Manchester area. He ran, of course, on the ticket to advocate for Palestinians once elected into the parliament. Of course, the by-elections, you recall, was triggered by the death of the sitting MP, Andy, who was, of course, taken over by a Labour candidate by the name of Azhar Ali. He was, of course, found in a leaked audio to have espoused quote-unquote conspiracy theories about Israel regarding the Hamas resistance movement's attack on October 7th last year. That, of course, paved the way for independent candidates and for George Galloway of Britain's Workers' Party with the promise of advocating for Palestinians. And, of course, he dealt with local issues, the so-called bread and butter issues important to the population in Rochdale. And as we saw, he won a thumping victory of more than 12,000 votes, which was indeed more votes than all the rest of the candidates put together. And he was sworn in, of course, into the British Parliament. This absolutely very divisive times, a lot of divisions in across the different political parties and within them as well. As you mentioned, the Conservatives are really flagging in the polls. The Labour Party, the opposition Labour Party also, that enjoys a lead over the Conservatives, have lost quite a few points in the polls as far as the Muslim vote is concerned. And the reason is obvious, which is, of course, their initial absolute support for the Israeli regime. And later on, under massive pressure from weekend after weekend of national demonstrations, a change in their approach, which got to a point where they started calling for an immediate humanitarian pause, not exactly a ceasefire, as we saw two attempts in the parliament to vote for an immediate ceasefire brought forth by the Scottish Nationalist Party, National Party, both of which failed to garner enough support for that motion to pass. The second time, of course, the Speaker of the House, Lindsay Hoyle, played what many call some kind of a trick, which was to adopt the Labour amendment to the SNP motion, which was voted on. Of course, pressure on the member of the Labour Party to abstain as well. That didn't pass either. So as I say, these are critical times in British politics. It's a country, a society that is very much divided on the way the UK has reacted to the ongoing massacre in the Gaza Strip. As we speak, 66% of people in Britain want an immediate ceasefire. And that, of course, has fallen on deaf ears in the corridors of power in Westminster. And when people have spoken with their votes at the ballot box, case in point in Rochdale, then you hear comments from the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, warning that Mr. Galloway's election to the parliament was alarming. That, of course, has caused a lot of waves and has prompted reactions from Mr. Galloway as well, who called Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, and Keir Starmer, the Labour Party leader. We've heard that expression as two cheeks of the same backside, meaning, of course, that they are more or less the same. There are others who are saying that with Galloway's return to Parliament will come leftist politics, a true left in the British Parliament, to pile the pressure, to bring pressure to bear on the so-called liberals and, of course, on the Conservative Party, which, of course, is something we'll have to wait and see come the first PMQs, which is tomorrow, Wednesday, the Prime Minister's questions. We'll see the first salvo across the bow of both political major political parties from Mr. Galloway when that happens, as I say, which is tomorrow. And, of course, a host of other issues, very many divisions. For example, the way that the immigrants have been treated, the so-called Rwanda plan espoused by the Conservative Party, and, of course, not a very different plan from the Labour Party either. That, too, will be an issue that will be something that George Galloway and the likes of him will be putting to the biggest political parties in Parliament when his parliamentary career as an MP for the seventh time, of course, commences.
Okay, so we should be expecting some more heated debates there in the House. Thanks for that, Saeed Purezak, my colleague in our London bureau. Now, moving on, pro-Palestine rallies have taken to the streets of the Chilean capital to demand the president there sever diplomatic ties with Israel over the regime's war on Gaza. The protesters carrying Palestinian flags and banners gathered outside the Israeli embassy. They chanted slogans against the genocide of the Palestinians and urged their government to take immediate action. In November last year, Chile recalled its ambassador to Israel, citing the regime's disregard for international law. More recently, in January, President Gabriel Boric even likened the Israeli war on Gaza to Germany's actions in 1945. Several other South American countries, such as Honduras, Colombia, Belize, and Brazil, have all recalled their ambassadors. Calls for the isolation of the Israeli regime are gaining momentum globally. Iran's Al Alam Arabic News Network has been once again targeted by censorship on Western social media platforms. Social networks such as X, formerly known as Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, have taken down all Al Alam accounts. YouTube deleted the network's channel on Google without any explanation, and that's contrary to the usual procedure of sending a warning and a possibility of protesting via email. That's not the first time Al Alam's social media pages have been blocked. In 2020, Facebook also removed the channel's verified page with more than 7 million followers. Al Alam has been at the forefront of reporting Israeli crimes against the people of Gaza. With that, we come to the end of this newscast. Thank you for being with us.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
The Conversation.
Hi,
Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the 1981 hunger strikes and the legacy of the 10 men who died. How did this seismic event change the direction of the conflict, and what have we come to understand about its impact for generations to come? My next guest is a former hunger striker who spent an incredible 70 days without food. He joined the strike on the 29th of June 1981 after Bobby Sands and three other IRA prisoners had already died in H-Block prison. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gillernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh, South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Lawrence McKeown. He is a former IRA prisoner, author and screenwriter. After serving a life sentence in prison, Dr. Lawrence McKeown obtained a PhD in sociology at Queen's University Belfast. He's also co-founder of the Belfast Film Festival in the mid-1990s. Lawrence McKeown, welcome to the show.
Good morning, John.
Good to see you, Lawrence.
So, Lawrence, tell us a bit about your childhood growing up.
Well, I grew up outside Rondlestown, which is about 20 miles from here. Very mixed area, religion-wise, and in a often hasten to add that I never see the conflict. Here is about religion, it's been about politics, but religion has been used as the empire has used, you know, tribal difference or skin colour or whatever else. So it's a very idyllic sort of upbringing. I've written about it that when I was 10 I learned to drive a tractor on a farm that was next to us, Davy Warwick's farm. Lovely neighbours, wonderful people. Went to a very small local school, Farran Fluch, which I was delighted about years later to discover it was actually from the original Irish, which was like wet townland, but at the time this anglicised version just seemed a bit absurd, you know. I ended up getting my 11 plus and moved from this really two classroom school to St Malachy's, the largest grammar school, and I hated it with a passion, and I think that's where my sense of rebellion started, because I began to mitch school, so I travelled to it and hang out down around Smithfield, or I'd never done Belfast before, but I just hated the school. I think it was this moving from this very informal, localised, rural sort of setting to now this, you know, you're studying Latin, and if you go to the gym, you have to have, you know, different shoes for different, you know, purposes and all the rest of it. So yeah, I blame that on my later activities. But very interesting that I was growing up through that period of the civil rights, and unbeknown to me at the time that certain things were unfolding that had had an implication for my own family, because I mean, the whole civil rights movement was about an end to discrimination in housing and employment, as you know, Michelle. But for me, the biggest impact was the activities of the Ulster Defence Regiment, which was a locally recruited militia, the largest regiment in the British Army, and over 90% Protestant. And there were people from Rondlestown who I would have known and played football with when we went down. Down the town, we used to walk down the town of Credivis. That was all you had in those days. And being stopped with them, and I remember the first night, I remember the guy's name and all, and him asking me, what's your name and where are you coming from, where are you going to? And he was embarrassed, because he believed me, saying to me, what's your name? Mm-hmm. But the second, third time it happened, the embarrassment had gone, and it was the arrogance. And I've been stopped and just been held in that None of us were involved in any politics or anything at that time, but it was a big influence on me, and I think it was at that point, certainly by the time I came to 16, realising that there are two communities, but it's not about what church you go to on a Sunday, it's about that one has the uniforms and the weapons, legally, and the other doesn't. It has, you know, it's IRA, and at that point, I was 16, I decided that I wanted to become part of what was happening, and to become part of was to join the IRA, which I did whenever I was 17 years of age.
You were on that 1981 hunger strike, Lawrence. You're a walking miracle. You went 70 days without food. Tell us more about that.
Well, in the 1981 hunger strike, there was initially only four people ever going to be on it. That began with Bobby and Frank and Patsy and Rimmon. And then one of them died that they would be replaced. So there was only ever going to be four on it at one time. But in June, it was decided to increase the numbers on it to eight. So each Monday, someone new joined it. Not because someone had died, but because they were bringing up the numbers. So I joined which was the last one out of that four to join on the 29th of June. By that time, four people had already died. I mean, a full set of people, you can only understand the hunger strike in the context of that 5 years before it, where it's a total, okay, you understand the big political issue, the criminalisation, attempts to criminalise the struggle, and so on and so forth, but it also becomes personalised with just even the prison guards, the screws at the door, you know. And it's not like, oh, well, you've got a range of choices, A, B, C, D, which one we go for. It was either you walk out with hands up and capitulate and become yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir, or it's hunger strike. And in that context, I suppose the biggest thing for me when I began it was a week later the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace came in. So I was taken up to the hospital along with Beck. I was in the same wing with Beck. And Mickey Devine was brought from H5. So it was an opportunity to see all of the people there. People were still alive. And important lesson also that day that everybody was brought in who was on hunger strike. The only one missing was Joe McDonald. And if I hadn't known that, I wouldn't have recognised the person that came through the door who was in a wheelchair. Joe was always nicknamed Fat Joe. He always had able to retain a bit more fat than the rest of us. And that's, which is all thing, most people were undernourished. Like I was 10 and a half stone when I began the hunger strike. I mean, about 13 and a half now or something, you know, when I'm not carrying massive excesses. Because everybody was malnourished after a long time. Mm-hmm. But Joe was brought in and his head was like over the side, he was in a wheelchair, and there were like troubles coming down the side of his mouth. And it's almost that thing where you see someone physically disabled, and it's almost a thing of thinking, well, maybe they're mentally as well. But when he spoke, he just knew this is Joe McDonald. And so everybody got a smoke. You were allowed to smoke in the prison hospital. You weren't allowed to smoke on the protest. And the makeup of the ICJP, the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace, was Dublin government appointees, Catholic Church, SDLP, so sort of not Republicans on the ground. And they were come to say that they had been in talks with the British government, and they had some like not only the basis of the five demands, but they were saying that even the six demands. And the whole thing went on for 2 days. And it's always that thing where people talk about, you know, was there deals and all this. There never was a deal. There was always offers of what would be there if you were to end this, and that was never going to be enough for us, given the experience of the first one, and particularly given now that four people had already died in the meantime.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildenew, alongside our special guest, Dr. Lawrence McKeown.
Martin Horson then died fairly suddenly and very painfully. And this is the thing, there are normally people died in different ways, but if you couldn't keep water down and you're told to drink at least 6 pints of water a day and take salt because you need it for your brain, but if you can't keep the water down and you're being sick, then all these toxins in your body start to, you know, the kidneys come under massive pressure. It happened to Paddy Quinn, it happened to Martin Horson. So like for the last couple of hours of his life, he's thrashing about, hallucinating, and he's away in another world. And I learned in later years after his release, and talking to Brendan, his brother, like Brendan was on one side of him holding him down, and the priest, Father Murphy, was on the other side holding him, so he wouldn't smash his face against the metal bed end. And then he did settle in for about an hour, and then he died. And the really, when you're in the hospital, the irony was you're no longer a protesting prisoner, because you are in the hospital, you're wearing pyjamas, so you're not refusing to wear the prison clothes. Around about 40-odd days, my eyesight started going, I think that was the same for most people, and seeing double, but very clearly double. And then that changed into a more hazy, fuzzy sort of thing, and then it starts to be a light, start to annoy you, and we had that like strip lighting, which is what anyway. But I suppose one of the main thing that we ended up noticing was that someone very close to death often had a bowel movement. And I remember I was thinking, I'd read before about how if you're hung, your bowel's open. And this was almost like in reverse, the body just letting go before it. And it happened until Tom McElwee, and I remember him and Mickey Devine talking about it. And afterwards, it was a real drop in it. You're ready, totally exhausted. But after that, usually nobody came out of their cell again in the ward, because there were cells, even though you're in a prison hospital. So it happened to Mickey Devine, and you knew they probably... what would reckon you two or three days after that, and then basically what happened. So when it happened to myself, I knew, and it's a very painful experience, and a very lengthy couple of hours, and literally just, I made it back to bed, I helped back to bed, and didn't get out of it after that. And then it was around that time that my parents were let in, families were allowed in, if they were seen to be at a critical stage, and they came in, my father, my mother, and sister and brother, all of them apart from my mother, asked me to come off the hunger strike, and I said I wasn't. And it wasn't because my mother was Republican, she wasn't. We just always had I don't recall any adult conversation with my mother, because I was on the run when I was at 17 and a half. Then I was in jail when I was 19. You only get an odd, because other people were visiting, and you don't get much time to talk about it. Then we're on the protest. So never... had those type of adult conversations that we really have liked, and both my parents had later died in jail, so never got to have them, but there was just always a very close bond. She just showed me unconditional love, and she wasn't going to ask me to do something that she knew was against me. That was the 68th day, and I remember them coming in. 69th, I don't really recall at all. Apparently I was responding to voices, but was getting confused, and I was just either sleep or starting to go unconscious a bit. And then on the 70th day, which was a Sunday, apparently the doctor goes around and checks all your reflexes and says, look, now you're in deep coma and you're not going to get any response. And what they had was power of attorney, which is that the prison weren't going to force feed us, but if your next of kin signed a document, the power of attorney shifted them and they could authorise medical intervention, which is what my mother did. And again, it was only in later years I thought back on it. What I do recall her saying to me on that 68th day was, and we were on our own, the daughter's gone out, and she says, you know what you have to do, and I know what I have to do. My mother was a very quiet person, and religious in the sense it was quiet faith, like she wouldn't have run religion down your throat, and an awful situation for families, and that had been brought on. I mean, that already been a number of people, and I've wondered if I had been the first, would have looked on it differently, or if somebody had died after me, would have looked on it differently. But neither of those happened. And I said, my own mother died less than 2 years after it. So it's this awful thing that families were placed in that dilemma, and a big pressure on them from the Catholic Church, and particularly from Father Fall, that a good mother or a good wife would authorise medical intervention, which by implication means that you're a bad wife or a bad mother if you don't. I regained consciousness in the intensive care unit of the Royal Victoria Hospital, just a few hundred yards down from here. And then the interesting too, thinking back on it, because it was a female voice saying, it must have seen it was coming around, said, Lawrence, you're in the intensive care unit at the Royal Victoria Hospital. We're just going to turn you over here slowly. And different ones, because I was 7 stone at the end of the hunger strike. You don't have any bones. In the hospital, they would have had you on a sheepskin rug, but in the hospital, they obviously don't have those. And was turned me over. And so I remember what was like this gentle hands on you. You know, it's a female voice, and it's a gentle touch. Whereas for like the previous 5 years, you didn't have any of that at all. and there were British soldiers in the bed, and all I could see, it's almost blind, you could see the black figures, and again, it was just hard to open the eyes. And then the following day, I was taken to the military, you know, the secure ward of the Moscow Park Hospital, where all the ones were there, like Paddy Quinn and Pat McGowan and that there. And was there for the next few weeks, and then moved back to the prison. Previous, they had kept people there maybe for 6-7 weeks, but I think again they'd come to a point where they were trying to put pressure on the hunger strike and on the people who were still on it. The time I was moved back, I was still holding on the walls to try to walk. I arrived back into H Block 4, and when you arrive in that block, there'd be a screw in the circle, and they're meant to shout the numbers. So somebody's going for a visit, it would have been right, one off, 98 here, or one on. And whenever I walked in, this guy shouted, one field hunger striker on. Normally to walk across, the straightest route was straight across the circle, but I had to walk around the wall, just holding on to it, and could hardly see. And ended up down in the wing, and people heard me coming in, and I was exhausted, literally. I got onto the bed and just lay down, and I'd ended up with nystagmus from the hunger strike, which twitching of the eyeballs, which were going rapidly, so to open them you became really nauseous because everything's just moving like this here. So it was easier just and someone in the cell next door to me knocked it and shouted and asked who it was, and it was Ron McCartney. He was on the first hunger strike. And I said who it was, and he got up and shouted out the door, and everybody was shouting up to welcome me and all the rest of it, and somebody said, come to your door, and it was just wiped out. And that was like three and a half weeks after the hunger strike ended, a few days later, and we had 5 demands, we got 1 demand, which are replaced not in the context. People say, oh, no, was it successful or not? And you say, well, you want to narrow it down to a prison, you 5 demands, you get 1. You don't really say, well, that's not success. But it was never about simply prison conditions. It was a much wider struggle. And if you look at it in terms of what we did get out and what the struggle got out of it, and it's all well known now, like the IRA got loads of weapons and money and political and moral support. And you realised afterwards that, you know, the eyes of the world were on it, and particularly, you know, the eyes of the world of those who had suffered under the empire. And I think maybe for the first time Republicans just realised just this support and interest that you had worldwide. You know, when you have Fidel Castro speaking up at the United Nations, you have the Indian Parliament holding a minute silence, you have protests, you know, across the world whenever Bobby died. So in that sense, it was a major victory. For us in the jail, we got the right to wear our own clothes, which, Fulton said, was important on two levels, symbolically. But obviously we wouldn't wear the prison uniform. And the blanket song was, I wear no convict uniform, nor make me serve my time. So we never did wear their convict uniform. But on a more practical level, it allowed us to get out of the cell for the first time in 5 years and get into the canteen and get out of the yard and plan and strategize how we were going to get the outstanding demands, which we did, through a whole series of protests in different ways. But that saw anything by 1981. That was the end of that type of protest in prison. The Republican prisoners, if you look at the history, burning in the camp, various other protests. Even the blanket protest itself, it's sort of like, yeah, bring it on, you know, we'll take it. And it's not in a macho way, but it's like Terence McSweeney's, it's not those who can inflict the most, it's those who can endure the most, which sometimes I wonder about, because you can crush people and crush their spirit. Thankfully, it never happened to us.
Lawrence, it's been an honour to have you in here today. Thanks for coming. It's always great to see you. Thank you. As we have come to the end of the series, I'd like to finish this episode on a different note. Much of what we've attempted to do during this last 13 weeks is offer an alternative look at Irish politics, free from the constraints of broadcast editorial control. We hope that you have enjoyed what we've had to offer, so rather than leave you with your usual history segment, I'd like to finish with a eulogy from one of our finest literary greats.
Leaving the white glow of filling stations and a few lonely street lamps among fields. You climbed the hills towards Newton Hamilton, past the Fuse Forest, out beneath the stars. Along that road, a high, bare pilgrim's track, where Sweeney fled before the bloodied heads, goat beards and dog's eyes in a demon pack, blazing out of the ground, snapping and squealing. What blazed ahead of you? A faked roadblock. The red lamp swung, the sudden brakes and stalling engine, voices, heads hooded, and the cold-nosed gun. Or in your driving mirror, tailing headlights that pulled out suddenly and flagged you down where you weren't known and far from what you knew. The lowland clays and waters of Loch Beg, Church Island's spire, its soft tree line of you. There you once heard guns fired behind the house, long before rising time, when duck shooters haunted the marigolds and bulrushes, but still were scared to find spent cartridges, acrid, brassy, genital, ejected, on your way across the Strand to fetch the cows. For you and yours and mine fought shy, spoke an old language of conspirators, and could not crack the whip or seize the day. Big-voiced scullions, herders, feelers round haycocks and hindquarters, talkers and buyers, slow arbitrators of the burial ground. Across that strand of yours, the cattle graze up to their bellies in an early mist, and now they turn their unbewildered gaze to where we work our way through squeaking sedge, drowning in dew. Like a dull blade with its edge honed bright, Loch Beg half shines under the haze. I turn because the sweeping of your feet has stopped behind me, to find you on your knees, with blood and roadside muck in your hair and eyes. Then kneel in front of you in brimming grass and gather up cold handfuls of the dew to wash you, cousin. I dab you clean with moss, fine as the drizzle out of a low cloud. I lift you under your arms and lay you flat, with rushes that shoot green again. I plait green scapulars to wear over your shroud.
I'd like to thank our special guest, Lawrence McKeown, and our resident co-host, Michelle Gildernew. We haven't gone away, you know. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome. This is the Ocean of Dua, where we embark on a journey to the profound ocean of spiritual insight. This is Mushtaba Farzana, your host for today's episode. Since the profound verses of the Whispered Prayer Sha'baniya are filled with wisdom and insight, we are going to continue our discussion on that specific segment of the Munajat. Through these discussions, we aim to uplift our understanding from the rich Islamic heritage. So without any further ado, let's get into today's segment of the dua. Open your hearts and let's embark on this journey together. I'll be right here with you when you come back.
إلهي أقمني في أهل ولايتك مقام من رجى الزيادة من محبتك إلهي وألهمني ولها بذكرك إلى ذكرك وهمتي في روح نجاح أسمائك ومحل قدسك.
Now that we have admired the beauty of these lines, let's read their English translation. My Lord, place me among those who show servitude to you, the position of those who consistently hope to increase your love. My Lord, please inspire me with a mounting passion for your remembrance and with an enthusiasm for the refreshing resort to your names and the station of your holiness. Dear listeners, in our previous episode, we promised to talk about different categories of wilaya. That's why we talked about differences between creational wilaya and legislative one, as well as the categorization of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, in this regard. In this episode, we wish to speak about a dangerous type of wilaya that we have to be vigilant against. Yes, that's right. It's the wilaya of shaitan that we seek refuge from to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Before digging deeper into the discussion, it is good to know that there is a difference between shaitan and iblis. Generally speaking, whenever the Noble Quran wants to name any evil, shaitan's name appears. But on top of this evil hierarchy, we have iblis, the excommunicated jinn. Now the question is, how does shaitan become someone's wali? It's simple. Gradually. According to the Noble Quran, one's journey to becoming Shaitan's puppeteer starts with following him. Listen to these following verses. وَلَا تَتَّبِعُوا خُطُوَاتِ الشَّيْطَانِ إِنَّهُ لَكُمْ عَدُوٌ مُّبِينٌ. Do not follow the footsteps of Shaitan, for he is your open enemy. إِنَّ عِبَادِي لَيْسَ لَكَ عَلَيْهِمْ سُلْطَانٌ إِلَّا مَنِ اتَّبَعَكَ مِنَ الْغَوِينَ. You have no authority over my servants except for those who follow you. As you could clearly see, we deliberately can choose whether to follow Shaitan or not. But when someone chose to follow him, then entering Shaitan's wilaya ensues, most likely. That's why the Quran commands to safeguard your limbs, for they are the initial steps for Shaitan to start with. Dear brothers and sisters, we have to attend to our souls more than to our bodies. Your soul requires constant care not to fall into Shaitan's trap. Tadrij, or graduation in English, is one of the predicaments that we seek refuge from in many of our supplications to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You must have heard the famous story of the boiling frog, where the frog dies due to its lack of understanding about the situation. Sometimes Shaitan tricks us little by little, for he's more patient than us. Before getting any further, let's take a short break and I'll be here with you.
Alhamdulillah, we have been given the blessed opportunity of witnessing another month of Sha'ban, which is the month of Allah's mercy and pleasure. حَفَفْتَهُ بِالرَّحْمَةِ وَالرَّضْوَانِ. Allah has covered this month with His pleasure and mercy. I thought it might be good to have a little introduction to Munajat al-Sha'baniyyah. The late Imam Khomeini, in many places, on several occasions, emphasized on this Munajat. And in one of his sayings, he said that there are many important mystical points that one can understand from the Quran and whispered prayers of Imams. And then in particular, he mentioned Munajat al-Sha'baniyyah. And he said, philosophers, mystics may be able to understand some aspects of these whispered prayers. But if someone wants to really understand, must be a person who has himself achieved a high level of closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so that he can have a taste, he can have an experience of what he says. In another place, the late Imam Khomeini said something very important. He said, this Munajat al-Sha'baniyyah is one of the whispered prayers that if someone pays attention to it and follows it and reflects on it, he can reach somewhere. He can achieve some levels of perfection. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us in this month of forgiveness and to be pleased with us in this month of pleasure. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless us, our families, our community, all humanity with His pleasure, with His reward, with the coming of Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, with forgiveness, with being able to remain always on the right path.
As of the dangers of getting under Shaitan's wilaya, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, those who follow Shaitan will put their trust into him, and he nurtures them so that they become his means to deceive people. It means not only a satanic person is going down himself, but he also takes some other people with him. So what should we do not to let Shaitan penetrate our hearts? The first step is to raise our awareness about the tricks and traps that Shaitan has planted for us. We can find many examples in our ahadith in this regard. For example, blending with non-mahrams more than necessary, judging, people, and extravagance are the most obvious ones. The second instruction to stop Shaitan according to the Quran is to rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He has promised those who show patience on His path will find tranquility. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ قَالُوا رَبُّنَ اللَّهِ ثُمَّ اسْتَقَامُوا تَتَنَزَّلُ عَلَيْهِمُ الْمَلَائِكَةِ. Inshallah, in our next episode, we will talk about other ways to stand against Shaitan. Until then, do not forget to keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان والعالم يقول لك احبك يا شعبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان شعبان بجمالك جلالك زهوبان والعالم يقول لك احبك يا شعبان والعالم شعبان احبك يا شعبان يا شعبان احبك يا شعبان
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.